Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And tonight we have, we're going to bring you some news, and we're also going to play for you an interview that we did last night on our FM radio show, the LA Steel Show, on Q103.3 out of Lakeville, Connecticut. And it's an interview with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, who are the authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. It was a great interview. Well, it was great because they're so knowledgeable. And after talking to them, I have a thirst for more of their knowledge. They know so much about Afghanistan. They've been there so long and so early. They were there in the 80s, actually.
The early 80s.
And so they could talk about Afghanistan when it was a society that was educating its youngsters and graduating them from secondary school. They could talk about it when it was a society who had hope for their culture. But what's happened is that Afghanistan has become a place where it's been manipulated.
It's a quagmire. I mean, it's the end of every empire that's ever gone into it.
It's a graveyard of empires is what it is.
And
the Silk Road is the road to ruin.
Yeah.
And that's one of the quotes that they had. But the interview was quite good because they're so knowledgeable. And both Leo and I felt at the end of the half-hour interview that we wanted to know more. And we're hoping that we get a chance to talk to Paul and Elizabeth again. So I think you'll find the interview as informative as we did. But right now, I'm going to bring you a little news.
Can you read this one?
Leo's chosen something that he wanted me to share with you guys.
I don't know if you can read that.
A few thoughts on the coup in Honduras, and this is from Rebel Reports. This is by Jeremy Scahill. There is a lot of great analysis circulating on the military coup against Manuel Zelaya in Honduras. I do not see a need to reinvent the wheel. First, we know that the coup was led by General Romero Vasquez, a graduate of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. As we know very well from history, these graduates maintained ties to the U.S. military as they climbed the military career ladders in their respective countries. That is a major reason why the U.S. trains these individuals. Secondly, the U.S. has a fairly significant military presence in Honduras. Joint Task Force Bravo is located at Sotocano Air Base, Honduras. The base is home to some 550 military personnel and more than 650 U.S. and Honduran civilians. They work in six different areas, including the Joint Staff Air Force, Army Forces, Joint Security Forces, and the Medical Element 1st Battalion, the 228th Aviation Regiment, a U.S. Army South asset, is a tenant unit also based at Sotocano. The JSTAF provides command and control for JTFB. I'm not sure what that joint something, JTFB. Dash B. I'm not sure what that means. But anyway, there are a lot of folks down there at that air base. The New York Times reports that the unit focuses on training Honduran military forces, counter-narcotics operations, search and rescue, and disaster relief missions throughout Central America. Significantly, according to Global Security, Sotocano is a Honduran military installation and home of the Honduran Air Force. The head of the Air Force, General Luis Javier Prince Soazo, studied in the School of the Americas in 1996. The Air Force has been a central protagonist in the Honduran crisis. When the military refused to distribute the ballot boxes for the opinion poll, the ballot boxes were stored on an airbase unit citizens accompanied on an, pardon me, were stored on an Air Force base until citizens accompanied by Zalala rescued them. Zalala reports that after soldiers kidnapped him, they took him to an Air Force base where he was put on a plane and sent to Costa Rica. It is impossible to imagine that the U.S. was not aware that the coup was in the works. In fact, they were basically this was basically confirmed by the New York Times in Monday's paper. As the crises escalated, American officials began in the last few days to talk with the Honduran government and military officials in an effort to head off a possible coup. A senior administration official who briefed reporters on the condition of anonymity said the military broke off those discussions on Sunday. While the U.S. has issued heavily qualified statements critical of the coup in the aftermath of the events in Honduras, the U.S. could have flexed its tremendous economic muscle before the coup and told the Miratelli coup plotters to stand down. The U.S. ties to the Honduran military and political establishment run far too deep for all us to have gone down without at least tacit support or the turning of a blind eye by some U.S. political or military officials. Here are some facts to consider. The U.S. is a top trading partner for Honduras. The coup plotters /supporters in the Honduran Congress are supporters of the free trade agreements Washington has imposed on the region. The coup leaders view their actions in part as a rejection of Hugo Chavez's influence in Honduras and with Zalala and an embrace of the United States and Washington's vision for the region. Obama and the U.S. military could likely have halted this coup with a simple series of phone calls. For an interesting take on all of this, make sure to check out Nicholas Kozloff's piece on Counterpunch, where he writes, in November, Zalala hailed Obama's election in the U.S. as a hope for the world. But just 2 months later, tensions began to emerge. In an audacious letter sent personally to Obama, Zalala accused the U.S. of interventionism and called on the new administration in Washington to respect the principle of non-interference in the political affairs of another nation. I guess that didn't happen because Zalala is gone. He's been sent to Costa Rica.
This interview is about 40 minutes long.
It's very good.
But I got I don't know if you wanted to read that. There's another one that I wanted to read here tonight. excuse me a second. This is called the Climate Bill is Transfer of Wealth to World Government. So this big climate bill that has been being passed and have just passed the House of Representatives and now headed toward the Senate, there's a big traitorous, miserable, transfer of wealth and destruction of this country. And here it goes. This is, and the odd thing is, this is by Pat Buchanan, who actually stated this. It's written by Paul Watson, but from Prison Planet. But he's quoting Buchanan.
Pat.
Yeah. It says during an appearance on MSNBC, political commentator Pat Buchanan defined the climate bill for what it really is. Not just a new tax on the American people, but a complete transfer of wealth and power to a global government that is using the manufactured fear of global warming to grease the skids for total domination. Referring to the passage of the climate bill and global warming in general, Buchanan said that the legislation was passed through the use of fear and that more and more scientists are coming forward to say this is a hoax and a scam, which is designed to transfer wealth and power from the private sector to the government sector and from the government of the United States to a world government, which is what we are going to get in Copenhagen when we get this Kyoto 2 agreement. Buchanan labeled the legislation a tax bill that would raise the prices of utilities for every American, hammer the middle class and the working class for a danger that we don't even know is really there. And the former senior advisor to three U.S. presidents accused the Obama administration of hyping the apocalyptic myth that the oceans will rise and that cities will be underwater in order to ram through the legislation. Establishment left-wing blogs like Crooks and Liars and Media Matters are carrying the video of Buchanan's remarks with little or no accompanying commentary, as if Buchanan's comments alone are enough to discredit his position. Those who act as skills for the climate change hoax may believe that anyone who dares challenge the orthodoxy of the Church of global warming is automatically a heretic, and that no evidence whatsoever needs to even be presented to counter their sacrilege. Okay, but here in the real world, we prefer to stick to the facts. Empirical satellite data shows that mean global temperatures are the same that they were 30 years ago, and the global sea ice is also at similar levels. Following a spike in global temperatures at the end of the last century that coincided with the sun undergoing its most active period in recent times, the planet has now cooled to 1979 levels. At the end of summer last year, despite hysterical predictions that the North Pole would be free of ice for the first time in history, Arctic sea ice has actually expanded by 30%, an area the size of Germany. And coinciding with expanding ice sheets, there has been no rise in sea levels for the past 3 years. Tropical storms and extreme weather events attributed to global warming like hurricanes and typhoons are at a record low. In the United States, IPCC, the heavily politicized organization that is often erroneously cited as an independent scientific body of climate change promoters, was last year caught citing fake data to make the case that global warming is accelerating, a shocking example of mass public deception.
Mm-hmm.
And this was starting, reported the reported the London Telegraph, across the world where there were reports of unseasonal snow and plummeting temperatures last month from the American Great Plains to China and from the Alps to New Zealand. China's official news agency reported that Tibet had suffered its worst snowstorm ever. In the U.S., the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration registered 63 local snowfall records and 115 lowest ever temperatures for the month, and ranked it as only the 70th warmest October in 114 years. Excuse me. It soon came to light that the data produced by NASA to make the claim, and in particular temperature records covering large areas of Russia, were merely carried over from the previous month. NASA had used temperature records from the naturally hotter month of September and claimed they represented temperatures figures for October. And as David Deming points out in his excellent article today, temperature data collected by weather stations is being artificially impacted by measuring systems placed nearby to sources of heat. This is why claims that global temperatures are still rising are completely contradicted by the real-world evidence of falling temperatures, and what some scientists are warning is the beginning of a new ice age. Why do people think the planet is warming, writes Deming? One reason is that the temperature data from the weather stations appear to be hopelessly contaminated by urban heat effects. A survey of 1,221 temperature stations in the U.S. by meteorologist Anthony Watts and his colleagues is now more than 80% complete. The magnitude of putative global warming over the last 150 years is about 0.7% centigrade, but only 9% of meteorological stations in the U.S. are likely to have temperature errors lower than 1 degree centigrade. More than two-thirds of the temperature sensors used to estimate global warming are located near artificial heating sources, such as air conditioning vents, asphalt paving, or buildings. These sources are likely to induce artifacts greater than 2% centigrade into the temperature record. Every year in the U.S., more than 40,000 people are killed in the traffic accidents, but not one single person has ever been killed by global warming. and the number of species that have gone extinct from global warming is exactly zero, and both the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets are stable. The polar bear population is increasing. There has been no increase in infectious diseases that can be attributed to climate change. We are not currently experiencing more floods, droughts, or forest fires, he concludes. As we have attempted to warn, the major beneficiaries of the climate change, of the climate bill, will be the elitists who own the carbon trading systems that will be used to handle the cap and trade program, namely Al Gore and Maurice Strong, who two figures intimately involved with a long-standing movement to use the theory of man-made global warming as a mechanism for profit and social engineering. Gore's investment company, Generation Investment Management, which sells carbon offset opportunities, is the largest shareholder of the Chicago Climate Exchange. And while Maurice Strong, who is regularly credited as founding father of the modern environmental movement, serves on the board of directors of CCX, which is Gore's investment company. And Strong was a leading initiate of the Earth Summit in the early 90s, where the theory of global warming caused by CO2 generated by human activity was most notably advanced. So, it's a lie, folks. I mean, it's a huge lie, and we've been saying this for quite a number of years. And Al Gore is a traitor, no question about it. You know, he and his globalist buddies have just maneuvered this thing, and now you get Obama. You know, and you got I'm going to refer everybody to a couple of websites and a couple of books. And if you could ever pick up a copy of Rule by Secrecy by Jim Morris, and then if you can go to davidicke.com, check out some of his work and listen to some of his lectures. And you know, after you do that,
I guarantee you it would change your life forever.
I mean, yeah, unless you're a complete bonehead, you know, and completely, cast in concrete, you'll never think the same way again. And
I don't know how you could think the same way.
And this guy Obama is just a nightmare happening. I mean, Bush was an absolute outright crook and criminal and psychopath. But this guy's yet to be defined. He's just...
Well, he's on a honeymoon now.
Well, he's on a honeymoon, but that's over. And I've talked to a lot of liberals in the last few months, and most of them, almost all of them, think we're on the wrong path and think this guy has betrayed us all. And it's pretty obvious to me.
Well, he didn't betray me because I knew he was a liar.
Well, he betrayed you in the sense that
he's betrayed
the country. You know?
Yeah, he's exactly what I thought he was.
Yeah, well, you're so smart.
That's why I couldn't vote for him.
Yeah. But anyway, that's
what
I
happened. Don't think I'm smart. I just am more jaded than the rest of you. That's all.
That's what you are.
Just but more jaded.
Nevertheless, I appreciate the insight. Wow. Anyway,
what can you do?
Yeah, this interview is about 40 minutes long, and I'm going to try to, hopefully it'll play without any interruption, and we will be able to get you the full, I hope you enjoy it. This interview is with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould.
Excellent.
They're so knowledgeable. Well, Lila hypes things up a little bit on this. I mean, it's an interview. So
I don't think I'm hyping it up. I think they have a lot of knowledge.
Yeah, okay. Well, they do. But I mean,
on an area where we haven't had much information, that's why I was so interested.
All right. So regardless, we hope you enjoy it. And now here it is. About 40 minutes.
Went to Afghanistan in the spring of 1981, and they arrived in the heat of the Cold War era, and they produced, in 1982, they produced a PBS documentary, Afghanistan Between the Worlds. In 1983, under contract to ABC Nightline, they invited Roger Fish to return with them to assess the chances of getting the Soviets to leave Afghanistan. throughout the 1990s, they continued writing about Afghanistan, human rights, and women, women for Afghanistan women, shattering myths and claiming the future. So I guess they have a real background on Afghanistan, and I'm sure there aren't too many people that do.
Good evening, folks. Can you hear us all right?
Good evening.
Good evening, and welcome to the show. Boy, you have quite a background on Afghanistan. I don't think there are too many people that can compete with you on that. You go back quite a while.
When did you first get started, and how did you get started into investigating or researching Afghanistan?
Well, actually, in 1979, we were actually focused on the arms race, because the concept of reducing arms spending was a big issue when President Carter was running for the presidency at the time. The whole idea was that he was going to usher in a new era of of peaceful competition with the Soviets, and it was going to be reduced arms spending through the SALT Treaty. This was a very active time for this. And so our documentary was focusing on the effects of arms spending and how, people we were interviewing, like John Kenneth Galbraith, were talking about how necessary it was to reduce arms spending, because we'd really reached a point where it was actually interfering with the ability of the civilian economy to move forward. So now, suddenly, the Soviets crossed the border in December 27, 1979, and all of a sudden, the entire concept of reduced arms spending, of negotiation, of civilian reinvestment is gone. And it just got our attention, because it was almost as if it was scripted. It just seemed too neat, too total. It was literally within 24 hours.
It was really just one of those points in time where we saw that the left and the right were arguing over a very specific point as to what the intentions of the Soviet Union were and whether we could actually engage in negotiation or not. And so when the Soviets crossed that border in December of 1979, suddenly all the arguments were just simply off the table. We were back at war again. The Cold War had been restored. So we both said, this is really an amazing issue. And we were familiar with some of the people who had been involved with the debate. We had been interviewing these people for our documentary. So we decided that, about 2 weeks after the Soviets invaded, the Afghan government expelled the entire Western media of 1,136 Western journalists. So we said, this is an opportunity to get an exclusive. This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Let's try to get the permission to get in.
And when you mentioned that this was almost scripted, who do you think it was scripted by?
Well, it seemed as if, there were those who definitely were not happy with the idea that there would be reduced arms spending, that the whole idea of the military-industrial complex running the economy clearly interfered with certain interest groups. We certainly didn't know who those groups were, but, when you look back those people who were, promoting these ideas, you've got Paul Wolfowitz, you've got Daniel Pearl, you've got, a lot of the same people that ended up actually promoting the Iraq War and using the same strategy.
When we sat down with John Kenneth Galbraith in 1979, he told us, he said, this is an industry, this is a self-perpetuating process. And he said, you really can't, at the time, the big issue was, how big the defense increase was going to be. And the Carter administration was already beginning to implement large increases in the defense budget. And so, the Reagan agenda was that those defense expenditures would be even larger. So the issue was that, the trigger was that this was a point where the people who wanted detente versus the people who wanted to increase the defense budget, the neoconservatives largely, not necessarily know whether they were considered that at the time, but it was the same group of people, as Liz mentioned. Paul Wolfowitz and was one of these people. Danny Graham, who had been, these people had been doing this sort of thing since 1947 in terms of ginning up the arms race.
Well, Paul Nitze,
right.
These were all the people.
Right. Now you bring up John Galbraith and Kenneth Galbraith, and I'm curious. I mean, I know he was involved with the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration. But was he? How? When? What? What was he? When you were talking to him, what was his position?
Well, he was a Harvard professor.
Other than that, he
had been the he had been the head of the Office of Price Administration during the Roosevelt administration during World War II.
But he was also
he had controlled prices during that time period. So he had also served as JFK's ambassador to India.
That's right.
India.
That's right. Yeah. And also he was one of the Under Mountain Boys, the Iron Mountain Boys.
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just curious as to at that time, like in '82 or so, was he when you interviewed him, was he just a professor at that point, or was he still deeply involved with the government?
No, I mean, you know, when you're a Harvard professor and you're operating at that level, you get called in for consultations. At that point, he was pretty much playing the elder statesman. He was looking at the situation and saying that he'd been in the government since the Roosevelt administration, since the 1930s, in running the Office of Price Administration during World War II, he understood the system completely from A to Z, and he was very familiar with what Eisenhower was trying to accomplish in his efforts towards the end of his administration in the 1950s, with reining in the growth of the military-industrial complex and what it was doing to American society.
To say nothing of what it did to Afghan society.
Well, you know, Afghan society, I mean, you have to look back, to understand what's going on in Afghanistan today, you really do have to look back to the 19th century, to the 1830s and the 1840s, and the debates that were going on within the British Parliament and the British government, the objectives of Anglo-Saxon foreign policy.
So
that's
very much
what the United States picked up in 1947 with the partition of India. We picked up the Anglo-Saxon foreign policy that Britain had been pushing out for since 1600, really, since the Elizabeth I, Queen Elizabeth I, actually chartered the East India Company, which pushed its way up into that part of the world for a couple of hundred years before it finally declared war against Afghanistan.
Yeah, but the East India Company was just 100% opium.
Drugs.
Okay, it was all opium.
Yeah. Well, the city of Hong Kong was actually established as a banking center for the opium trade, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it had absolutely nothing to do with
tea. Then the CIA took that over.
Well, the MI5, yeah. And I believe it's been...
Are we still carrying out Anglo policy then?
Anglo-Saxon policy?
Yeah.
Well, it is certainly, we have been asked this on many occasions when we've spoken this. Isn't it rather strange that 93% of the heroin in the world should suddenly, be focused on an area that is under the control of American forces?
It reeks of
and now we have it at a
conspiracy.
Well, I don't want to be accused.
No.
Oh, we don't want to be a conspiracy.
I just don't think there is such a thing as a conspiracy so much as the fact is I just think this is just the process by which these things operate.
Look, I'll tell you, let me ask you, this question I got to ask you really, just to be upfront. Who do you consider the best journalist, the best journalist in the country, in the world?
The best journalist in the country?
Beside yourself.
Oh, Ahmed Rashid would probably be up there in the top 5%.
Rashid
is a Pakistani journalist who's covered this issue from the very beginning.
All right.
And he certainly...
Now, who does he write for? All right. Does he have his own...
He's a Pakistani-based journalist. He's put out a number of books, and his issues are... His articles are syndicated around the world, so...
Okay, then that's good. Who would you consider a top journalist in this country?
In this country?
Yeah.
That would be a tough one. I think Paul Krugman from the New York Times is a columnist, I think, certainly has done
a columnist,
of books.
Yeah, but I mean...
I'm not exactly sure I'd classify him as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't either.
No, as much as an economist. You know, the fact is that when we were in Kabul in 2002, about 9 months after the war ended, we actually went around and we interviewed all of the American reporters that were there. And photographers and reporters, and one and all said pretty much the same thing. They said that they can write it, but their editors in New York won't print it. And in the last 25, 30 years, that the language of understanding the world in which the United States operates has been so degraded in the United States that the American people simply do not understand the issues that are going on. we do not get the kind of documentation and the kind of journalism in this country that is necessary to understand the problems that we face. And as a result of that, the American public is very easily manipulated by complicated issues that really aren't complicated if you know, if you've got a scorecard in terms of who the players are and what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Right, and there's also another element, too, that I think really has to be brought in, is that even the best, journalists on any one subject can hit some kind of moment when, they just don't have, the sort of the entire, landscape of whatever's going on. But what we're dealing with is the difference between journalists, I think, who really have done, whatever they can do to try to present as total a story as they're capable of, versus those people who really have allowed themselves to really slice and dice the story according to, interests that may be putting pressure on them. And that's a very different kind of situation. Unfortunately, I feel as if I'm more qualified to talk about journalists who have done a poor job than, it seems as if, the problem is more visible in when it fails than when it succeeds, because you never know when you're going to hit that moment with certain journalists where they just suddenly, the story falls apart.
I mean, somebody like Peter Arnett is an example. 30 years ago, you could pick up and go to a CBS News or an ABC News or CNN, maybe not 30 years ago, but 20 years ago, with a story. And, and they would finance your ability to go in there as an independent and get an independent look in terms of what was going on. There was a guy in New York named John Alpert, I believe, back in the 80s, in the 70s and the 80s, around the same time we were doing our thing. And, he used to go off to Vietnam. He went off to Vietnam right after the Chinese had invaded. And, you were able to do that, and they appreciated that. You could go to New York, and there was a respect for that independent viewpoint in terms of what was going on. That's been completely erased. That was erased during the Reagan era, the late 80s and into the 90s. Now you've got a point where if a journalist wants to get the story in Afghanistan or Iraq or someplace like that, you've got to get yourself embedded. And the attitude of the military towards the correspondent at this point is that if you're not embedded, you're the enemy.
Oh, they were shooting you guys. I mean, they were shooting journalists over there.
Oh, there was a general who just was reported a few months ago. He had an article where he's retired now, but he came out and he said that they were going to have to start a policy within the military of executing reporters and journalists who did not kowtow to what the American goal was in that particular theater of war.
Yeah.
Plain and simple. I mean, it was just, we're not talking any nonsense here. We're just talking, if they're not on your side, you just shoot them.
Wait, in this particular war, in the Iraq war, he lost more journalists and camera people than any.
Well, they clearly were targeted.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
I mean, look, right, what was it? Right after the invasion of Baghdad there, the American tank turned and fired on the Baghdad hotel or something where all the journalists were?
Yeah, they attacked the Baghdad hotel.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the resistance to actually naming any journalists that's that good, because they may be targeted.
that's true. But I know they're out there, and I know they're somewhere, and we've had...
Oh, absolutely. But I feel as if what we're dealing with is, you just come upon something that really, sort of resonates authentic,
right.
And, you follow, the leads that you get from that, and you get somewhere, and you feel as if you've got some movement with the story.
Now, I meant to ask you, what's your opinion about investigative journalism, bloggers, and websites, independent websites, and independent journalists that are doing some very good work? Do you?
Well, that's a great thing. It's a great opportunity. Unfortunately, we have to live with this whole issue of censorship. Look what the Chinese are doing now. They want to sell computers that they're mandating that computers that are sold in China have filtering software on it that you cannot, so you won't be able to get to certain websites.
Right.
And we've already seen that. I mean, we're seeing it with our own internet service. When we try to send certain emails around that other people have sent to us, we get a notification from Verizon that this is considered spam and it cannot be sent.
This is our own email going out
right.
to someone we've chosen, and we're told it's spam.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And this is, it's becoming, they're obviously scanning the email, and they're determining that whatever it is we're sending, whether it's a name of a restaurant or whether it's a website, that somehow it qualifies as spam. In the meantime, of course, we're being inundated by things that really are spam. So I mean, this is the kind of technological thing that we're facing at this point. We're in a very, very critical moment in time. What's so interesting is that what we saw in Afghanistan in the Soviet invasion in 1979 is very, very similar to what we're facing right now. The only difference being is that we're a lot further down the pipeline than we were in 1979. And we're getting a sense of deja vu every time we read an article or we see Zbigniew Brzezinski appear on a television program telling us that
now you got his idiot daughter.
She's embedded in the media.
Embedded with Joe in the morning.
Doesn't it make you sick?
Makes you gay.
Well, this is a private, the network news is a private game preserve,
absolutely.
This is where, you've got to, they give you a blood test before you go in there. And I don't mean, for disease, they give you a blood test to make sure it's blue enough in order to get to...
Well, they make sure that you don't have any brain, that you're not a robot.
Anyway,
you got to be a puppet
to be in there.
The biggest robot they got right now is Brian Williams. I mean, what a robot that dude is.
Well, once you're in the system...
Okay,
just like getting into Harvard, once you're in, they absolutely are there. 100%.
You're there. You're in the Marine Corps, too. You're there for life.
Yeah. Well, look at the big jerk Dan Rather. I mean, the biggest clodhopper and biggest idiot that ever that was ever on television.
Dan is a very special case.
I didn't know what the hell he was doing for the last 20 years of his career.
Well, when it came to Afghanistan, starting in 1980, Dan did an excellent job of propagandizing the Afghan story. That's what Dan did.
Dan was the point man for.
He took over Cronkite's editorial position, and he created the news.
And created is the word.
They created the news.
Point man as far as Afghanistan was concerned. I mean, he went in there. He supposedly went in there over the mountains in the spring of 1980 and made a very dramatic presentation of what it was like to, sneak over the Soviet lines. And that's what we were also inspired by that, too, because we were the first Americans to actually get a visa to go in legally. And we flew into Kabul and we sat down with these people and said, what the heck is going on here? And they said, we've got these crazy Mujahideen coming over the mountains, and these are the people that we had locked up in jail here, and they escaped and went to Pakistan.
Did you know that? Were you aware of that Dan Rather was in Pakistan interviewing Osama bin Laden on the 10th of September, 01?
Was he really?
No.
Yes. There was evidence that he was, and it came out. We reported this, maybe 5 years ago when it came out. But, he was actually supposedly seen, and there was record of him in the Pakistani hospital, all right, and that he had actually interviewed Osama bin Laden.
Well, that's interesting because on September 10th, another story that was out there was that Don Rumsfeld was actually telling a story about the fact that he had tracked that about $3 trillion lost in the defense spending process.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
All of a sudden on September 11th, that went away too.
Isn't it interesting?
Very interesting.
Yeah, you have, but this is the invisible history, right?
Yeah.
Now you guys have just written a book called The Invisible History, all of the things that's there, and yet do you advocate or do you support any of the conspiracy, and I say theories because, that's what they're called, but do you believe in any of these conspiracies that are out there?
Well, I'm not exactly sure that I would refer to them. I mean, there's certainly some of them are conspiracies, technically conspiracies. I mean, two people conspired to do something.
Right.
That's what a conspiracy is, right?
Exactly, right. Okay. And a group of people conspired.
The fact that, all these major events occur in the world and you have to sit back and say, it just happened on its own. That's beyond naivete.
But there's another side to it, too, and the fact is that when you look at how dysfunctional everything is, it makes you wonder if they actually set out to really, carry out this supposed conspiracy, why would it go so well? So it does make you wonder, what really is going on.
The fact is that there are always people out there who are looking for an opportunity to get an agenda across. That's why you get into the game.
Well, you can't
Afghanistan is referred to as the great...
Yeah. Now you can't tell, you can't say that the neocons and Bush boys and whatnot were not conspiring to take over this country. You can't say that Newt Gingrich and his gang of renowns, all right, didn't conspire to take over this country. All right.
Well, you know, the thing is that the problem is that they did conspire to do those things. Clearly, you know.
But yet nobody says, oh, he's
around in a
conspiracy.
Deciding what the policy is going to be and how they're going to get it done, you know, that's technically, yes, that is a conspiracy to do that. And the fact is that what, in my own question is that why doesn't the organism of state, as an example, to create or maintain a healthy state, step in and say, all right, we're not going to allow this private interest group to manage the levers of power.
Well, I think that's when you get into the whole issue about, you know, the idea that a corporation was given the rights of a human being, and now we're dealing with that infusion.
No, I think it's because you have 565 conspirators, co-conspirators in the Congress, and one huge conspirator in the White House. Okay, and that is why I believe there's a conspiracy here. All right, and I believe most people in the world believe the United States is just a roller coaster conspiracy.
Well, I think
to take over all of these regimes. I've got articles.
People in the world at this point are just.
I know what we are. I mean,
Americans, when they go overseas, they're just astonished at the way we are.
Hold on, folks. One second. I had a mishap here with our tape again. Damn. So, anyway, the article goes on and on. I will be getting this out in just a second here. Sorry for the inconvenience. When this thing pops, it pops. Sorry, folks, for the delay. A mechanical failure. It's 17 minutes remaining in the show, and I'm really, really sorry for this. It was a very good interview. I'm hoping I can get it to get it back without ruining it. It's just beyond me how this happens. Anyway, I want to. One thing that they said that I was rather surprised at, and I really do hope that you go to their book, excellent book. Just hold on one second here. Try to restore this tape. So anyway, hold on one second. Almost there. Hopefully I can play this. Before I continue, I'm going to read this quick article here while I rewind this tape. An article that came up on the 28th of June, and it was by Sherwood Ross, Global Research, and published by globalresearch.ca. And it was called the CIA Crucified Captive in Abu Ghraib Prison. And it talks about the poor bastard that was crucified there in Abu Ghraib. And the Central Intelligence Agency crucified a prisoner in Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad, according to a report published in the New Yorker magazine. A forensic examiner found that the prisoner had essentially been crucified. He died from asphyxiation after having been hung by his arms in the hood and suffering broken ribs. And the magazine Jane Mayer writes in their magazine's June 22nd issue, military pathologists classified the case a homicide, and the date of the murder was not given. And hold on one second here. I'm going to try to revise this tape. Hold on. We might have it all back by within a few minutes, within a minute or two. I've got to be careful rewinding tapes because they just, it's an archaic technology. It should not be used anymore. But unfortunately, the way that my studio is set up, not this particular one, but the way the radio station is set up when I record this program, it has to be recorded on a tape because the equipment is not sufficient. I mean, the equipment is not... they have the equipment, but they don't have enough memory to... it's just a big problem. So I wind up having to redo the tape. I have to redo everything on tape. So bear with me, folks, and we will get back to this, hopefully, back to this...
You know, the Bush administration, most Americans would go over to these and say, well, you're just anti-American.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think a lot of people are just wandering around saying, I don't know who my government is any longer. I don't know, you know, what it is to be an American. And, you know, I'm personally not, I've lived here all my life. I grew up here. My parents were born here. They grew up here. And I have to admit, I really don't know what it is. What is it that we are as Americans today? Are we just simply here to support biotechnology experiments? I know that's a big issue up here in Boston. I mean, we've got more biotech firms in the Cambridge area or around MIT than probably anywhere else in the world.
Well, we do a...
you can take a stroll down the street. You know, we had a conversation with an MIT professor, and he said that, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, he said, you know, the military would come into MIT, and they'd say, you know, we need new kinds of electronics to do all these different kinds of warfare. Well, ever since the 1990s and the biotechnology thing has came along, it's all about biotechnology. The military isn't asking for new kinds of planes or tanks or ships or guns. They're asking for microbes. So I think that, you know, if you really want to get, you know, paranoid about this situation, all you have to do is just sit back, and that's going to be the biggest conspiracy of all.
Well, look.
It already is. We cover this every week on this show, just on a segment just devoted to chemtrails.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you people know and see, but I mean, if you just look up on any given day, all right, you see this military operation crisscrossing through the sky, creating a weather modification.
Yeah.
And
that's worldwide.
And
that's
that is a global
not just
issue.
Here.
That's a global military operation.
Well, look, they've been putting arsenic in chickens since 1944. So I think it's a pretty good sign that...
I didn't know that.
Right, yes.
I didn't know that.
That was in the newspaper just the other day.
The Washington Post had a major article about that. So
why do they put arsenic in chicken?
They put it in for, apparently that was their way of dealing with parasites and other issues, but the fact is it's obviously very dangerous for humans, it's very dangerous for the people who work with it, and the FDA approved it in 1944. It's just another indication that some of this
is
absolute insanity. It's not... that is not a conspiracy. That's insanity.
Yeah. Now, that's still being done.
It is still being done. In fact, the Europeans apparently dropped the use of arsenic in 1999 and forbid it from coming into Europe. And I guess in this country, there are companies that are on their own, like Purdue and Tyson, are dropping it on their own. But it's not mandatory.
Well, it's no different than using formaldehyde, but carbon monoxide. Okay, they spray beef with
carbon
monoxide. With
that, to make it look better.
To make it so it stays red for another couple of weeks.
It's I think, again, that is just an indication of how idiotic this process is. So, again, in terms of when you're dealing with, you know, like you talk about, you know, like seeding the weather and creating some kind of change in the weather,
sure,
the military implications of that, you know, but then when you look at some of these other insanities, like putting mercury in, you know, in the injections that they put into babies. And,
look at the vaccines, my God, yeah. I mean,
and you realize that there is a running insanity in all of this that is just, you know, it's beyond conspiracy.
No, absolutely, and I believe that we're being, you know, that our governments are actually run by sociopaths.
Absolute
criminal sociopaths.
Well, if you saw the way they were doing things in Afghanistan, you would know that for sure.
You know that, right?
No question about that.
Really? That's a sad thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
The fact is that, you know, as I said, we were there in 2002. The Afghans welcomed the American presence with open arms.
Even though 3,000 Afghans were killed, they still went.
If you look back at the history of Afghanistan, these people had a very moderate, progressive society. They were definitely, you know, in fits and starts. They were moving into the 20th century. And they were definitely trying to, you know, to modernize their country in the middle of a very, very difficult situation. They had been pressured by the Russians and by the British colonialists for, you know, 150 years. And they finally had the opportunity in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s to finally break out of that colonial mold. And they would just be set. I mean, it was considered a golden era. The 50s, 60s, and 70s in Afghanistan was considered a golden era by people who visited there, who lived there.
You had 20,000 students graduating out of...
By the mid-1970s, 20,000 students a year were graduating from their secondary schools.
In fact, they actually had so many students that was part of their problem. They didn't have an economy large enough to handle the amount of educated people that they had.
They had been handicapped by colonialism for so long that they really... Their access routes to the sea had been cut off in the 19th century. Their most productive provinces had been cut off by the British. They had seized them. And so as a result of that, I mean, people in the United States don't remember what it was like to be a colony. So it was so long ago. But
right.
The fact is, you know, the taxation, the burdens that the empire puts on its people,
mm-hmm.
and that was what was going on in Afghanistan. And finally, of course, it just collapsed during the 1980s.
And that's what's so interesting, too, about when Afghanistan really saw the United States entering and replacing the British Empire, you know, when the empire was really dissolving at the end of World War II, and the creation of Pakistan, and out of mostly Afghanistan, though, two-thirds of Pakistan was actually created out of Afghan lands. And, you know, this, even at that point, was considered by the Afghans to be a great opportunity, because they felt somehow that their own sense of independence and their kindred spirit was in the United States. So they were really looking to the United States as a kind of new partnership. They had been dealing with empire through the Russian Empire, through the British Empire, and this was going to be a new relationship. And they were really devastated that the United States absolutely just simply ignored them and just picked up the British attitude towards Afghanistan and really, you know, took on Pakistan as the sort of sole American ally in the region.
I wanted to ask you, how did the Taliban get hold of Afghanistan?
The Taliban was the creation of the CIA and Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate. Pakistan's own CIA.
Right.
That started in 1992, formally. Okay.
Oh.
And so that you're looking at a stage of the evolution coming out of the 80s when the Mujahideen, who were basically financed by the United States through Pakistan, were really intentionally selecting the most extremist groups, the most fundamentalist groups, the ones who were, in many cases, drug-running criminal elements. Moderates were absolutely sidelined, in many cases being killed.
So if you want to talk about a conspiracy, the conspiracy was that they were painted by the CIA and by Pakistan as being indigenous to Afghanistan.
Right.
This is a kind of natural outgrowth of Afghan society, okay? And
yeah.
That was anything but the case. That was an absolute fabrication.
Yeah.
That's all Central Intelligence disinformation.
Well, the PSYOPs programs they've had with Al-Qaeda has just been outrageous.
Oh, yeah.
It's just totally absurd. You know, I mean, Osama bin Laden, I mean, you saw that Bhutto had said that She knew that Osama bin Laden had been assassinated, and she knew the guy who did it. Do you remember that?
I saw that interview, yeah.
And she was gone shortly later. She was assassinated.
With David Frost.
Yes,
And within a few months.
Didn't question her on that.
No,
automatically I thought when she said that, she meant Massoud, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Right. No, she said
right.
Osama bin Laden, and he just didn't even wink.
He didn't blink. No, he just accepted it. Yeah, I know that. As if he knew it too.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly what I thought. But and then she said it almost matter of factly, like everybody knew.
Right. Exactly. But that's the interesting thing about this is that when you pack up and you actually go to these places.
Right.
When, you know, and you talk to the people that are there, and you talk to the news reporters that are there, you get the whole picture. And then you come back here, and you start trying to explain it to people, and they say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, they've got you
absolutely confounding, you know what I mean?
It's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
With all of this sort of grim history, and it is very grim, and of being manipulated and misrepresented, what is the future for the Afghani people?
Well, at this point, the most important thing is to realize is that the Afghan people still are the Afghan people. I mean, they have been obviously subjugated. They have been oppressed by the United States, especially utilizing Pakistan's obsession with its belief that it's going to have a war with India.
Mm-hmm.
And Afghanistan really has been, sort of the victim of that process and really has never had an opportunity to really find its own ground again, especially since the Soviet involvement. So, what we're looking at today really is the sort of third sort of episode of, will the United States finally get it right? You know, in 1989, when the Soviets withdrew, we blew it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In 2001, we blew it. Okay. This is it. This is our third opportunity to actually get it right. And all we can hope is that at least at this point, there's going to be more and more people questioning what is going on, wondering why it isn't being resolved, and seeing that it's obvious it could be resolved.
You know, the Afghan people are, as Liz said, the Afghan people are still going to be the Afghan people. And
right.
The fact is that I don't think, we have to finally. I think Washington has to start trusting the Afghan people in terms of what they want for their own society. But, there's been so much propaganda put out for so long at this point that most Americans don't really know what the real issue is. The fact is that the Iranians, the Indians, and the Chinese and the Russians do not want the Taliban in any way, shape, or form in control of what's going on in Afghanistan.
And of all people, the Afghan people do not want the Taliban.
The Afghan people don't want the Taliban in control. It's only the United
States. But the damn
Pakistani. They talk about negotiating with so-called moderate Taliban.
But the Pakistani people now are threatened by the.
Finally, the Pakistani people are getting effectively the blowback of
those
Afghans have been subjugated to.
Well, now you got the Taliban, 60 miles outside of Kabul. I mean, it's like negotiating peace treaties all the way down the line.
Right. And they don't make good negotiators when it comes to
No, I don't think so. They just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But, what was fascinating to me, and I'll bring this up quickly only because with Keith Snow, who had done a lot of research and been in Afghanistan, brought it up on our show, and he said that Karzai's brother.
So the tape's okay. I'm just going to turn it around. Yeah, Karzai's brother is the largest dope dealer in Afghanistan.
About whatever's going on with the Karzais and even with the Afghan government, the kind of corruption that actually went on in the international level absolutely so overwhelms whatever the Karzai government is doing and his family that it really isn't the issue.
But it's part of it.
It's part of it.
I mean, if the president of the country,
Karzai was handpicked by the United States.
Yeah, he was a Chevron puppet.
No, he really wasn't an authentic Afghan leader that actually grew out of the the people of Afghanistan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was very much handpicked and when he went in there, one of the first things he did that was an absolute crisis was he accepted
warlords back into the Afghan government. The warlords had never been a part of Afghanistan. Suicide bombers were never a part of Afghanistan. So this was all a direct result of the financing the United States was involved in the 80s, putting in the hands of very dangerous people who were moderately powerful and empowering them tremendously.
You've basically got three political groups in Afghanistan. You've got the Islamists, of which Karzai is one.
He's
a moderate version of that, but he's still an Islamist, okay? On their side.
You've
got the neoliberals, who are the pro-business people the Bush administration put in 2001. Right. Those are the people who've been running the show. Those are the people who've been running the show. And then you've got the progressives. Those are the old Mohammed Daoud, the nationalists, who were trying to create an Afghan state.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm 5 minutes late for my
station identification. Just hold on a minute.
Sure.
Yeah, this is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millerton. You're listening to the L.A. Steele Show. And we have with us right now Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the authors of The Invisible History of Afghanistan, The Untold Story. And continue. I'm sorry. I have to get
back. Yeah, it's important. I think it's important for us all to know what the political breakdown is in Afghanistan right now. Up until the Soviet invasion, you had a group that was called the Progressive Group, and this was supported by the royal family in Afghanistan. It had been supported from the turn of the 20th century, and there was a king in the 1920s named Amanullah from 1919 to 1929 who was very Western-oriented. He implemented women's rights. He stopped slavery. He was introducing land reform very aggressively. And, of course, he was opposed by these conservative Islamists and by the mullahs up in the mountains but in the rural areas. But the fact was that he was improving the lot of the Afghan people, and that was generally accepted. So there was a lot of controversy. In 1929, he was overthrown. And it was hinted on many occasions that he was overthrown. He was with the help of the British. And so from 1929 until the early 1970s, there was a very, very kind of moderate but progressive group within the royal family, members of the royal family, that moved the country forward bit by bit. And as we said earlier, by the mid-1970s, you had 20,000 people a year being graduated, men and women, being graduated from Kabul's secondary school education program. You had, the beginnings of a kind of middle class that was coming up, which is what their objective was. And that's when, the Cold War, 1975, Vietnam War ends badly for the United States, and the whole confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union shifts to Afghanistan. It shifts to South Central Asia from Southeast Asia, and then you get Zbigniew Brzezinski gets into the Carter administration as the National Security Advisor, and in the middle of 1978, in the summer of 1978, he manages to get Jimmy Carter to give him control of the Directorate of Operations for the CIA. That's not the intelligence division. That's the operations division. These are the guys that go out and overthrow countries and do covert operations. And that's what's very interesting is because from that moment on, from the summer of 1978, things started to pop in Afghanistan and South Central Asia to the point where by December of 1979, the Soviets were invading. And one of the things that we did in the book, I came across a cable that had been written by the head of security at the State Department to Warren Christopher, who had been, I believe, the Deputy Secretary of State during the Carter administration. And it was a discussion. It was after the 1978 coup, the spring of coup by the Marxists in Afghanistan, and he was advising Warren Christopher as to what the status of the United States was vis-a-vis Afghanistan. And he said that the Shah of Iran had been preparing an invasion force to intervene in Afghanistan should the Marxists or the progressives become too powerful in Afghanistan. And he said, since there has been no support, I guess he won't be intervening. He won't be using his invasion force. So here was a case where, 18 months, 2 years before the Soviets invaded, the United States was aware that the Shah of Iran, who was America's ally, was preparing an invasion force into Afghanistan. These are the kinds of things that were never broadcast. In fact, even experts in Afghanistan, in this country, when I informed some of these people that I had discovered this cable, they were completely unaware of it. So, and that's been a big issue. Did the Shah of Iran really induce the Soviets to invade, and did their pushing up on the border of the Soviet Union really kind of threaten them? Well, that also ties into the whole nature of the way that Brzezinski really had utilized the Black Project 6 months before the Soviets actually crossed the border into Afghanistan to intentionally induce them to come in. And part of that campaign was a propaganda campaign to spook the Soviets into believing all kinds of things to sort of guarantee that they would feel they had to invade in order to stabilize the region. And part of that was what was going on in Iran. And part of it was what was going on in the southern border in the, you know, in the Muslim countries that were, you know, part of what the Soviet Union was.
So it would appear that what the Soviets were responding to was the belief, whether it was real or not, the psychological operation, as you talked about before.
All right.
The United States was going to put troops, was going to invade Iran, and then the Hafizullah Amin, who was the so-called Marxist leader of Afghanistan, would then invite the United States in. And that would then ring the Soviet Union from Iran through Afghanistan and Pakistan.
But you have to realize, Amin actually was actually believed to be CIA. In fact, Adolf Dubs, who was the ambassador to Afghanistan that was assassinated in February of 79, went to the CIA station chief in Kabul and asked him if he was CIA. That's how far the rumor had spread.
That's how bad it got.
I have to, I've run out of time here for this, but I wanted to invite you people back again.
We really enjoy listening to this.
Yeah.
To this history, it seems like we're still in the same situation that we were in the 19th.
Well, that's what's so astounding, is that, as I said, we're really at the same kind of middle of a vortex that we were in 1970.
Looking at
Obama as being very much like a repeat of the Carter administration at this point.
Yeah, I'd like to have you back again in the next few weeks, if that's possible.
Can you talk a little more about this?
Of course, we'd love to.
But I would like to first add, I wanted to mention your names, Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, and the book...
Invisible History, Afghans, Untold Story.
And our publisher is City Lights.
Okay.
And we have a website, invisiblehistory.com, and it's also on citylights.com.
So people can find out and get it there.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. We've really...
Citylights.com and Invisible Story.
Invisible History.
All right, so we hope that people will do that, our listeners, and we'd like to have you back in the very near future, and I'll discuss
talk a little more
tomorrow or something.
Okay, terrific. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay, and that was our interview with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould, journalists who have spent a great part of their careers working in Afghanistan or reporting about Afghanistan. And, you know, we appreciate them being on and giving us all that information. And we may have them on again in a couple of weeks. But I want to thank everybody for listening. And please join us tomorrow night when we venture into the spiritual world. And also on Friday night when we spend our night with George Dixon and discuss esoteric knowledge and Mayan calendar and 2012 scenarios, ufology. We have a number of topics that are ongoing on our Friday night show. So please join me tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and when we discuss, you'll see the selected reading that we'll have tomorrow night. And good evening.